say you've got a lot things there that you want to discuss.
Yeah, well, I have a pretty busy mind 50 weeks out of the year, and then 2 weeks, or it used to be a month or 2 months every summer, I take off. And this last year, we went up the woods in Canada, and there were no newspapers or radio or television to interrupt our vacation. We were camping in the woods. And I turned my mind off completely to what I was doing at home and returned. But now I'm back at home, and my mail was there, and the letters were there, and the newspapers were there. And when I saw the amount of material that I have to read after a two-week vacation, it takes me 1 month to get caught up. I don't think people really understand what it is to keep up with daily events in a thorough kind of a way. I have 90 newspapers at home that I've put now into piles according to the days. There are 17 magazines that I take seriously, I have to read and cross-file. 4 back issues of Computer and Automation. We've mentioned that magazine before, Gloria. And I'm going to give the address for librarians or whoever has a pencil. I've been telling everyone to have a pencil. If you want to subscribe, they have an issue every month on the use of computers to solve political assassinations in the United States. The publisher is Berkeley Enterprises, 815 Washington Street, Newtonville, Massachusetts, 02160, 950 a year. I think the libraries in this area should order these magazines, and people, private citizens, would find them very interesting. The back issues I got, one subject is the assassination of President Kennedy, the application of computers to photographic evidence. Another issue is the assassination of President Kennedy, Section 2 of the photographic evidence. The third issue of August 70, back issue, was the assassination of Robert Kennedy, the bullet holes, 2 men with guns drawn. And that lists the entire lawsuit, which I have mentioned several times on this program, of Theodore Sharaj versus the Los Angeles Police Department. And he files a lawsuit under his name and all the citizens of California. That's the way the lawsuit reads. And I think that's interesting because you people are named in a lawsuit. All of you who are listening are, he has put you into the category that you are involved in this, your lives. And it is Theodore Sharaj and the people of California, of the state of California, versus Edward Davis, chief of police of Los Angeles Police Department, the Los Angeles Police Department in total, Evel Younger, who is district attorney of Los Angeles, who's now the attorney general of California, and Robert Yoten, chief of detectives. And he has charged them with hiding the conspiracy of Robert Kennedy in a very malicious way. Someday I'd like to just read the entire suit. It would be a good program for you to see, being as you people are part of a suit. He thinks that your lives are involved and it's important. And then the new issue of another back issue which arrived was Patterns of Political Assassination. How many coincidences make a plot? Now, I told you that my cross-filing system, I have these many, over 100 categories, and one of them is coincidences. Just pulled out of the testimony on the John Kennedy murder, the coincidences in that murder. And when a member, a lawyer from Washington, was out seeing my book, it just blew his mind, and he wanted to copy it right away and put it into the computers. I had picked this up very early, and whenever I saw a coincidence, I put it into this book and cross-filed in other places too. And now the computers are feeding how many coincidences do make a plot. The new issue of Computers and Automation arrived while I was away, August 1971. An article on Jim Garrison, District Attorney of the Orleans Parish versus the federal government. And it goes into the background of Jim and his service and his role of District Attorney and how he didn't jump into the assassination thing as a fluke, that in 1963 he was aware immediately and went to certain persons' homes, David Ferry's home, and suspected people right away and has been on it, then accepted the Warren Commission report, and it was Senator Russell Long of Louisiana who was sitting on an airplane with Jim going east and said, "Jim, I think something happened. Oswald didn't do it alone." And he was the one who told Jim to get the books and read. It was Senator Long. And that's when Jim got really seriously into it, because Oswald had lived in New Orleans. And by word of mouth in the community, he was already picking up who the people was that Oswald had seen, and he knew their connections to Washington in different positions. So he has been on this since 1963. And this is a good article. We could spend just endless programs just reading each one of these articles because this is all new information. All I can do in 1 hour is throw out the sources and hope that you will pick them up, because we could spend a whole day on Jim Garrison's background and how they've stopped the case from rolling along, his lawsuits, and what evidence he really had. But I'm giving you the name of the magazine, and ask your libraries, if you can't afford $9.50 a year, ask the library to order it and start reading it. Then when I returned, besides the newspapers, magazines, I had 1,900 pages sent to me that I mentioned once before in a program from the National Archives. Much of the material is classified that researchers can't have for 75 years, and we're trying to break that barrier down. And much of the material that the Warren Commission had is available if you go to Washington and want to sit there, and it's microfilmed and you can copy it. And I mentioned that one of the researchers in Los Angeles knows the area that I work in. He's working in a very special, marvelous area. He's worked 7 years on it. He's doing a book that'll just blow everyone's mind. Marvelous researcher, David Lifton. And he knows that I'm interested in Marina Oswald, Lee Oswald, as agents of the United States. And nobody except Mabe Russell in the United States has ever ventured to say that Marina was brought over as an agent. All the other researchers differed with me. I'm sure they've changed their mind recently. They thought that after the murder of Marina's husband, that if the FBI took care of her and filled in the FBI story, that then she would get her citizenship and be a good girl, and that's why she went to live with the Secret Service right away and has been protected. And I think it's the other way around. I think the deal was made in the Soviet Union before she ever came over here. But I have 1,900 pages. Now, what does that mean? That means that some of these things, I took one page, and I'm going to read you just a couple of comments from this kind of page. I'll read you one page, and I have to cross-file one page, sometimes four times. I'll have a sentence in there that is important to me, and I'll put it in a book called Commission Erred, where the Warren Commission made an error. They made an observation about Marina, and they didn't follow it through. And then I'll put under Marina Lied. And because she has said something else in another place. And then I'll file under Lee, the agent, in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, because it pertains to who he was seeing or where he was. And then maybe I'll file under housing, because the lie, or where they erred, had to do with where they were living or their job. It had to do either with where he was working or where he was living or who he was seeing. So if she lied about where he lived, I have to put under housing, and I also have to put under lie. And I have to put under commissions errors. So that means that not all these pages, but many, many of them, I'll be working all year cross-filing those 1,900 pages. Now, I will read you just a little bit of how the information that came from the National Archives blew my mind. What I have now are the working memos of the commission lawyers to each other. And Lee J. Rankin was the chief lawyer of the Warren Commission. He wasn't the appointed member of the commission. He was the working lawyer. And Arlene Specter, District Attorney of Philadelphia now, was the lawyer in charge of asking Marina, or doing the research on Marina's questions. So from the archives, these pages read like this. They have a five-column thing, and they have the date that they're going to ask the question. Then they have the question they're going to ask her. She was the first witness before the commission. Then they have information from Marina, which they call just that, information from Marina. This is her version of what happened. Now, another column is information from other sources. Now, you can see, Gloria, how amusing this gets, because Marina is saying there's the name of a female in her notebook or photograph thing, in album or in her diary, and she doesn't know that person or remember hearing from them. But the other sources know that Lee Oswald was in contact with that person. So this is information from other sources. And then at the end, last column is called comments. That means things that Arlene Specter or the commission or the lawyers thought that they should go into. So the comments, we talked on the last show, I lose track of the dates, I believe, but I was talking about George de Morenschild and George Bowie visiting Marina and how the wealthy oil people in the area had come down to see her and were alone with her. And they said she was from the same town, and I made the remark, don't buy that, don't believe it, that she is this kind of a person. Well, one of the comments in the columns of the working staff was, "I feel that we should attempt to discover whether Marina is the simple peasant girl that everyone thinks she is."
What program did you say that on here?
Oh, it was the last week or the week before.
Yeah.
Remember?
I remember you saying it.
Don't
yes.
believe it.
Well, last week you did with Phil.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
So they said we should attempt to discover whether she's the simple peasant girl. The very first program, I believe, and I wish we could go back and resume all of them and carry a continuous series, and I'll try to publish at the end of a year in one book, where I said Marina will go down as one of the most famous women in history, that she's very quietly in Richardson, Texas, but someday she will go. Now, the commission, under commission errors, is that they never did go into whether she was the simple peasant girl. You see, that's where their errors were, or how are they going to try and make us believe it, because there's no way to believe. But now that my research is complete in this area, imagine how exciting to receive the memos of the working staff confirming all that I could figure out by what she said and who she saw and where she was. And they're filled with doubts, and then they publish the Warren Report and don't take into consideration looking into the avenues of their doubts. You see? So then there was another question. They asked her where she worked in Minsk, and they have a note. Marina refused to reveal the name of the people in charge of her section. And then there's another comment. Under comments, they asked her a certain question. And then this is one of the comments of the commission staff. "If Marina was used to recruit Lee, her associations during this period are important. We should remember that Lee was specifically assigned to work in Minsk, January 1960. Marina arrived there August 59. They met in March 61. Now, the commission felt that she could have been used to recruit Lee. If anyone is following this each week, they will appreciate the comments of the commission, and we'll go on to some more. They asked her the name of Ella Sobolova, a girl in her diary that was mentioned. And the comment under Marina, Information Marina, they said, "Marina does not list her as a friend from Minsk." Now, under comment of the Warren Commission lawyers, they said, "However, since there is some evidence to the effect that Lee has been in Leningrad, which Marina denies, it would be useful to know whether Ellie knew Lee, and if so, where did they meet?" Now, the background on the Soviet Union is that Lee went to the embassy on a Saturday and said, "I don't want to be an American citizen. Here's my passport." He went to the Russian side and was with Russians from then on. And a year and a half later, he wrote the embassy and said, "I want my passport. I want to come back." And John McVicker and Richard Snyder testified under oath to the Warren Commission that they did not know the existence of Lee Oswald or where he was all this time for 16, 17 months. Now, it would be hard to lose track of this American who was going to give over your radar, but under oath, this is perjury, they had no trace of him. If the men under oath, under the witness testimony in the hearings before the commission, said they didn't know where he was, how do the lawyers know that he was in Leningrad? How, you see what I mean? I have the working memos of the commission, so there's perjury going on in Washington right and left, because if the embassy didn't know it, how did Washington know? Washington would certainly tell the Soviet embassy, American embassy in Moscow, where Lee Oswald was, and they said they had no trace of him for 16 months. They asked Marina this question. Here's a question. "Did you know Lee was an American when you met him?" Marina. They answered, "No, but she was told by a third party that same evening." Comment from, this is another source, says, "She thought he might have come from a Baltic country." Commission lawyers comment, "He was only in Russia about 17 months. He certainly learned the language quickly," and that was underlined by them. "I told you Oswald was a smart boy." And the commission know, if a Russian girl didn't know that he wasn't a Russian, in 17 months he learned equivalent. Then the comment of the working staff of the lawyers had this to say. "Uncle," meaning Marina's uncle, "must have had a phone for Lee to make calls." Now, what kind of a comment is that for the staff? They didn't know where Lee was. How did the commission know what telephone calls Lee Oswald was making from Marina's uncle's house? And how did they know that he used the uncle's phone? Who was he calling? The working lawyers of the Warren Commission knew that Oswald was making phone calls at the uncle's house of Marina Oswald, and he's the head of the MVD. He has a high office, an officer in the Secret Service, right, are CIA. And how did the commission know that Lee Oswald was making telephone calls from the uncle's home? And when our embassy says they didn't know where he was for 18 months, the embassy, the heads, these are top government officials, have said they didn't know where he was. But the lawyers in Washington know he was using certain phones, they know what cities he was in, and they know he was assigned to Minsk. That's their language. He was assigned to Minsk, you see. Now, another question. They asked Marina to describe her meetings with Lee Oswald. And Marina's answer was she met him at a cultural event. And then she said this was on a Friday night. And she saw him at a dance the next Friday. Now, 7 days elapsed. She saw him with a lot of people in a group one night. 7 days elapsed, and she saw him at the dance the next weekend. It wasn't a date. They were both there. So that was two times that they saw each other. And then 7 more days elapsed, 6 more days, and Lee was in a hospital. He asked her out for that third Friday. He met her one Friday. They met the second week, and he said, "Will you go out with me the next week?" But Thursday he called her. He was in a hospital, and he couldn't see her. So she went to see him in the hospital for 10 days. So 7 days passed between their first date, and 7 days passed between the second meeting. And he was in the hospital 10 days, and he proposed to her in the hospital. So they had a total of 6 days together before they were married. And I figured out the time was they had a marriage ceremony April the 20th. And he was in the hospital 10 of those days, and 14 of those days he didn't see her at all. And no member of her family was at the ceremony. She has an aunt and uncle she lived with, and she and Lee went to some, I don't know where you get married, so you're like a judge or somebody. There's no witness to say they did or didn't. But she had a service, and they walked back to the aunt and uncle's. She didn't see her aunt and uncle when she left the Soviet Union. She didn't say goodbye or tell them where she was going. They did not attend the ceremony at all. Now, Lee Oswald applied to return home to the United States February the 5th, 1961. He met Marina March the 17th, 1961. All waivers from the State Department, they were passed for her. There was a section that should have been checked out on her political affiliations, which our State Department urged urgently, get him home quick, forget about her waiver. And the first night they met on their first date, they had been at a meeting of a woman who had just returned from the United States. Now, I want someone in Washington to tell me what state that woman visited the night that Lee and Marina had their first meeting. They went to the home of a lady who had returned from the United States. What is her name, and did she come from Texas? We want to know that. I want to know that as a researcher. Now, that I have 1,900 pages like that, Gloria, to get caught up. I don't see you for a long time.
Yeah.
That is the kind of information that just arrived to me from Washington.
Do you think you're going to be able to find out who that woman was?
Oh, I don't know if we'll ever be able to break any of this, but I think there's certain keys to the doors, and if people want those keys and you won't want to use the vague word like conspiracy or who could it be, how can we find them, where do you go to find them, people have names, they have jobs, they have passports, and we could find out who is involved if you people out there care enough. You will unlock these doors if you care enough, and we'll jump to that right now. I told you before that Washington was on vacation, don't write to Congress, but about September the 15th, they'll be back at their desk. And we had a wonderful response here of letters, right?
Right.
Before. So new people listening, old people listening, begin writing to public officials about September the 15th. And then Milton Frumkin at Saddle Mountain said we could have a big rally or a meeting up there late October. And what I would like to do, people wanted to meet me or ask questions, and we don't have the talk show. And what do you think of the idea, Gloria, of having a big kind of a meeting or small? I would rather have just a few who want to effect changes than a lot of just curiosity seekers, you know. And I thought the ticket of admission, we'd have a big rally or a picnic, a box lunch, would bring a letter from some public official that you sent in the past 10 weeks or in the next 6 weeks or 2 months to show that you care.
Dated sometime after September 15th.
Well, nobody wrote about assassinations before then. Yeah,
right.
Bring a letter, a return that from some public official. I got a letter this week from a girl who lives in the area, and she wrote to Edmund Muskie, asking him about the National Archives and information, getting the archives. And she was very disturbed because Muskie sent back a form letter in which he tells her that he wants the Pentagon papers declassified and they should have an orderly process of declassifying. In effect, means nothing. She was talking about the conspiracies to kill presidents and candidates. She did not ask about the Pentagon Papers. Mr. Muskie did not answer her question at all. I would accept that as a letter to come to a meeting, a box lunch. That is good enough.
Right, yes.
No letter, a letter of avoidance, like this other friend who wrote to Proxmire. And he didn't put in a thing about, I want to open the archives, or I think they should be shut. And he sent her some printed document on why they're locked for 75 years. That is a letter of admission. Anything to show that you have tried. And I think maybe we could read at the thing the kind of answers you're getting, how everyone in Washington, bring your letters and we'll read them from a microphone, or if there's enough for everyone, we'll read the way they answered.
The questions posed and the answers received, right?
Yeah. And try some of those real phony liberals up there, too. Don't forget them. I mean, Muskie and McGovern and Proxmire, I mean, and Ted Kennedy. Write to your favorite congressman that you, or senator that you like. And then get those real phony balonies out there that are stomping the nation. You know, Ted Kennedy's off in Pakistan looking at some starving people. He could do that in his own state. You know, in terrible conditions in this country, and he's off there. Just get them back to this country, and let's see what's going on in this country. So I think that bring your letters, write in about 1 or 2 weeks and bring your letters.
All right. You went to Canada on your vacation. Well, vacation
it
in
was.
Parentheses.
It was.
So, in quotation marks. You said that on your way up there, you heard something about about the assassinations and the Sirhan and the.
That's right. When I'm away, I buy no newspaper and I read absolutely nothing if I can help it. But I do like music, and we turn the radio on loud and zoom along. And we stopped up outside of Eureka, California for a picnic, and there were some tables there, and forest rangers were having lunch. And on their table they had this portable radio, and there was talk about the two guns in Los Angeles and the Sirhan case and that suit that's going on down there that we mentioned many times and can't talk about enough because there's dead silence down there. They don't know how to handle that with the fatal rifle thrown away, you know. They're trying to make you forget it, and I'm not going to let you forget it. But these men were listening, and I said, oh, do you mind if I listen? I couldn't believe that outside of KLRB, anybody's talking about political assassinations, you know, really. I said, can I listen? And he said, oh, sure. And I said, I'm on vacation, and I don't listen to the news, but I'm a researcher, and it just blows my mind that you people are able to hear now these things about the Robert Kennedy murder, that maybe Sirhan didn't shoot the fatal bullets. And they seem, you know, really stunned. You know, it's just like saying George Washington wasn't the first president. You know, I mean, like, where did this chick come from? Did she follow the trees or something, you know? And so he said, well, then who did the grassy knoll? Who killed John Kennedy? And I said, well, that was a crossfire. You know, that Oswald didn't have a rifle that was a crossfire. He had a roll, but it wasn't to shoot. And they said, oh, you know, they looked and the news changed and we had our picnic. And I mean, they just didn't know where I came from, you know. They didn't disbelieve, but the expression was really funny. And then the rest of the time we had radio and we were in Victoria going up towards a little town north of near Miracle Beach. And somebody was talking about the Poor People's March and Abernathy and Martin Luther King. And the way they were talking about it, I thought was really far out. And all of a sudden they went into the reasons why the FBI seems to be involved in the killing of Martin Luther King. So I got out a pencil, I was driving, I keep a tab there to jot down, and I thought, no, this has to be Harold Weisberg, and it was. And it was a talk show coming out of Victoria, a radio station there that was talking about the new book, Frame Up, Harold Weisberg. I have here for you, Frame Up, the King Ray case, and the publishers distributed by E.P. Dutton. Pacific Grove Library, I think the Monterey Carmel Libraries are carrying it. Several friends have asked for it. It's a good book. It's complicated, but it's good. It's, Frame Up. And Harold Weisberg was talking about the FBI and the role in killing Martin Luther King. So I did get just 3 days out of town and on my vacation, I got that news. And then the other news I got coming down from Forbidden Plateau, this mountaintop where we're up high, like the Alps and beautiful. And I heard the tail end of a thing on Mrs. Jackson talking about the killing of her son. And I turned stone cold. I just was so ashamed. I was so horrified.
You know Mrs. Jackson?
No, I didn't know her. But I mean, everyone who knows what's going on in California knew that he had to be killed. And the commentator in Canada was saying, quoting her as saying that it was a setup. And they said, this is really far-fetched. Everyone in the United States is getting paranoid about these murders. And I was listening to him, and then I couldn't actually believe, because I have the book, The Letters of George Jackson, and the only thing I could say is that I really was horrified. And for people listening, and this is assassination dialogue, and I will go into political assassinations. 2 weeks ago, the New York Times Sunday section, if you go to your libraries, dated August the 1st, 1971, the magazine section has an article, George Jackson Radicalizes the Brothers in Soledad in San Quentin. He's a brilliant writer. He's one of the finest minds we had in the United States. And they asked him, are any black people guilty of crimes? And the interview is a long one. You have to get from your library. But one of the things he said were the Jews of Warsaw in 1944 and 1945 criminals? Or is it criminal for a black mine worker in the Union of South Africa to steal a diamond? He said the first crime in this world, the very first crime, is attempting to establish a society above a society and then questioning whether blacks have been any part of the American society. Now, George Jackson was very brilliant, and what he said pertains to why I'm talking about assassinations now. I want to avoid bloodshed or violence, but he says that every revolutionary psychiatrist accepts as elementary the tendency of violence to turn inward. And people, when there's an economic oppression that affects a dying civilization, this country, he says, was decadent 100 years ago economically. And it is not realistic for a small knot of men and women to protect their constitutional rights to own or control the means by which people live, and then to define criminality. This is what he is saying. Now this, I know that in the case of the Kennedy murders, and we're going to go into, again, the subject of blackmail in the Soviet Union, how it affects world politics, a handful of people thinking they could hold on to the wealth or the minerals and escalate the war and build the runways and make the contracts, they have taken resources from this country and killed John Kennedy and other candidates who could affect social changes which are not communism, but which would lead to a bloodless change which has to happen. And in this conspiracy business, if we don't find out who this handful are, you will get as much violence as you got in San Quentin. This is only the beginning.
You're listening to Dialogue Assassination with Mae Brussel. This is KLRB Stereo FM, Carmel by the Sea.
When you think of the loss of the black leaders in this country and what is happening to this country, it's similar to Germany with the Jewish people expelled. There's been a saying heard over and over again that ever since World War II, since Hitler, Germany has been an economy. It's never been a culture. And this is happening. Some of our most beautiful cultural heritage from the black people in jazz and philosophy and true religious spirit is being kicked away and killed and not appreciated. And the same spirit that was in John Kennedy or Robert Kennedy or Martin Luther King, you have Bobby Seale and Huey Newton tied up in trials, and Hilliard, Fred Hampton dead, Martin Luther King dead, Whitney Young dead, Russell McGee locked up, you know, with endless problems in prison, Elrich Cleaver out of the country, Rap Brown is gone. If you add a list, I could add many, many more. Fred Hampton was shot down in his sleep. These are brilliant minds. They've written things, the things they say, they're telling you something, they're telling you the truth. And all of these murders, I feel all these murders wouldn't be possible if the political assassinations hadn't taken the turn they did. If the people who took power in our government had remained in power and hadn't been killed, I don't think we would have had this situation today. And I think it can be halted. It can be halted with the evidence that I'm trying to throw out or give to people. And first you have to believe it can be. And you have to believe these people's lives were beautiful and that they had something to say. And that our prisons in this state alone are like Auschwitz. And you have to wake up the people in the town of Auschwitz, pretend they didn't know what was happening. Soledad's in our community. September the 7th at MPC, there's going to be a meeting of families of Soledad inmates and former prisoners. And I think you should go just to hear or meet these people. Don't stay isolated. Young people dropping out, older people, disbelievers. Spend one evening, turn off the TV or a movie or a walk somewhere and just go out to MPC and meet human beings who have been in there or people whose children are in there now. See what crimes they were put in, how long they're in the hole, and realize that your life is directly related to their life. It has to be on this earth. Otherwise, we're going to have a Germany and we're going to have endless deaths. And you had in every culture, the Russian Revolution, the French Revolution, the Chinese, it was because the people who could effect changes wouldn't understand or listen. There were many chances to make changes, and this is our last chance now, I believe, and this is why I work hard for a bloodless coup, and there's plenty of warning that it's going to get bloodier.